I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. My next guest might be considered a traumatized madrasa misfit. She's turned a 200-page letter addressed to her fellow Muslims into a book. It's called The Trouble with Islam. Her name is Irshad Manji. The New York Times calls her Osama bin Laden's worst nightmare. And it's easy to imagine why that might be the case. Irshad is an outspoken critic of Muslim leaders who blame the West without any of their own introspection. She is a lesbian, a feminist, and a television personality in Canada, where her own opinions about the trouble with Islam have drawn her everything from high praise to death threats. Manji insists that Islam is on very thin ice with her. She's hanging on by her fingernails, anxious to hear what's next from the men she calls the self-appointed ambassadors of Allah. This hour, we'll talk with Manji about her ideas. We'd like to hear from you as well, Muslims and non-Muslims alike. Do you share Irshad Manji's criticisms of the religion and her calls for change? Is it about time that someone took the stand that she's taking? Or do Manji's criticisms only underscore Western stereotypes of Islam as a backward religion? You know our number. It's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. The new book, as I said, is called The Trouble with Islam. The author, Irshad Manji, is here with me in the studio. Nice to have you here.
Salam wa alaikum.
Salam. Alaikum salam.
Wa alaikum salam. There you go. Salam. Not bad, not bad.
So, what in a nutshell is the trouble with Islam? What's the bumper sticker?
You want the elevator summary, do you? All right.
Just to start us off.
Well, in my religion today, I'm arguing that lives are small, individual lives are small, and the lies that we Muslims too often tell one another and now the rest of the world are too big. What do I mean by individual lives are small? In too much of the Muslim world today, there's the ill treatment of women, the Jew bashing and Jew baiting in which Muslims even in here in the West persistently engage, and the continuing scourge of slavery in regions that are ruled by Islamist regimes. So you can see, Dick, that, you know, my concerns about the faith really boil down to a passion for universal human rights, and how they're being violated regularly in the name of God. And when I say that lies are too big, I'm talking about the fact that we Muslims have a tendency to point fingers at everybody but ourselves. It's the CIA. It's U.S. foreign policy. It's MTV. It's the Jews. Or the more sophisticated among us say, it's the State of Israel. And, you know, of the five fingers that Almighty God has given us on one hand, I would ask my fellow Muslims, if one can be pointed at America and another can be pointed at Israel, what are the remaining three fingers to be pointed at? And can we bear to have even one of those fingers pointed at ourselves? And if not, why not? Are we so unimpeachable? Are we so perfect?
So what's a Muslim refusenik? That's someone who decides to stay with the religion but kick away at it?
Well, not quite. I mean, when I call myself a Muslim refusenik, that does not mean I refuse to be a Muslim. That should be obvious since I care enough about my faith to have written this book and take my lumps for it. By Muslim refusenik, I mean that I refuse to join an army of automatons in the name of God. Anybody's God, including my own. And that's why I ask so many questions in the book. I actually provide fewer answers than I do ask questions. And these are questions that are asked precisely to create conversations where none existed before.
Let's talk a little bit about you. You your family came to Canada fleeing Idi Amin in Uganda. And you were raised in Richmond, British Columbia, on the West Coast, beautiful part of the country. But you also write in your book that you didn't have a very good relationship with your dad. You talk about him threatening you, chasing your mother around the house with a knife.
Chasing me, actually.
Chasing
not my
you?
Mom. Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Sorry. And then you talk about your, well, actually, I should ask first, the Most Promising Christian of the Year award.
Okay, now you've just put a whole bunch of episodes of my life together. I'm not really sure how to respond to one or the other, but let me just take up one very important point. The reason I stated what kind of violence I grew up with was not to blame my father's violence on Islam. I know that's an easy, lazy argument to make about what I'm saying, but the reason I went into that detail is to show my readers why the freedoms that I breathed outside of the private realm, outside of the home, the mosque and the madrasa, impacted me as strongly as they did, because I knew what the alternative was. And the repression that I experienced in the private realm was in sharp relief to the democracy of thought and expression that I experienced in the more public realm. It was almost a personal clash of civilizations. And for years growing up, I tried to reconcile the two.
I'm a little bit lost here. You're saying that it was a personal clash of civilizations,
but it had nothing
to do with Islam?
My father's violence, I don't think, had anything to do with Islam. But when, you know, in this part of the world, Dick, it's easy for people, Muslim and not, to say, freedom? Ah, big fat whatever. We're going to take it for granted. And I can't take it for granted because I know what a lack of freedom feels like. And that is why, having wound up in this part of the world, I frankly wake up every day thanking Allah that I have, as a Muslim woman, I have the freedom to dream big dreams and to tap much, if not most, of my potential. Had I grown up with this kind of violence everywhere I went because of cultural insularity or anything else, I don't know that I would have had even a conception of what the West offers me by way of freedom of thought, or as a result, how much more humane and compassionate Islam is capable of being.
But you said when you pull the lens back and you take a look at what's happening in Muslim communities around the world, you make the point that men feel that their religion gives them the right to treat women badly. So, I mean, it's sort of easy to make that kind of connection.
Easy doesn't mean accurate, and easy doesn't mean inevitable, Dick. And I think it's very important for your listeners to hear from my mouth that I have not made that connection. But you have alluded to another important point, which is that we are told as Muslims, even here in the West, that because the Quran comes after the Torah and the Bible chronologically, it is the final and therefore perfect manifesto of God's will, not given to the kinds of ambiguity and inconsistencies and contradictions like all those other sacred texts. No, no. We know, and I put no in quotes, that the Quran is not like every other sacred text. It is God 3.0, and there shouldn't be none after it. And I'm arguing in the book that this line that we are fed by mullahs and imams, and indeed from our own parents a lot of the time, is dangerous. Why? Not because I think that, you know, liberal Muslims or moderate Muslims will somehow become fundamentalists and start hurling bombs at the infidels. That's a shallow argument. I don't go there. The reason I think that our supremacy complex with respect to the Quran is dangerous is that when abuse happens under the banner of our faith, most Muslims still, however educated, however professionally successful we may be, most Muslims still have no clue how to debate, dissent, revise, or reform, because we have never been exposed to the virtues of asking tough questions about our sacred text. And frankly, I don't think that that can be as much said for Christians and Jews.
You were 14 years old when you kind of went nose to nose with your madrasa teacher and disagreed enough with how he was telling you to live your life that you walked out of class.
He actually ordered me to stay or leave, but if I leave for good. And the circumstances under which this happened was that for years I had been asking tough questions about the faith. Actually, what he considered to be tough, what I considered to be pretty basic. You know, why can't girls lead prayer? Why, even if the Quran came to Prophet Muhammad as a message of peace, did he command his army to kill an entire Jewish tribe after receiving that message of peace? But the final question, final by my madrasa teacher's choice, and over which I got booted out of the madrasa, came at the age of 14. Having read the Quran front, back, and sideways, I asked him, where is the evidence of the so-called Jewish conspiracy against Islam? You love to go on about it, sir. Now tell me, where is the proof? And he yelled at me, either you believe or you get out. And if you get out for good. And at that point, under such an ultimatum, I knew what I had to do. And so I stood up and adjusted my itchy polyester chadar, itchy because, frankly, I was sweating underneath. It's not like anyone wants to get kicked out of their school. And made my way to the hefty metal door of the madrasa, was so, you know, upset by his refusal to engage in conversation that I did something I probably shouldn't have, and that is I kicked open the door and yelled, as a memorable exit, "Jesus Christ!" And little did I know just how memorable it might have been. I had no idea at the time that Jesus was a Jew.
Is it fair to take you from that 14-year-old moment to fast forward to September 11th as
No.
a way of looking at the origin of the book?
No,
What's
not
missing,
at all.
Then?
Big time missing. What I explain in the book, and I will tell you again now, is that after being kicked out of the madrasa, I had a crucial choice to make. I could have walked away from my Muslim identity and got on with celebrating my secular, emancipated North American self, or I could have given Islam another chance. And out of fairness to my faith, I say fairness because maybe my madrasa teacher was just a lousy teacher. Out of fairness to my faith, I gave Islam another chance and another and another. Dick, over the next 20 years, I spent time studying Islam on my own. When there were no radio shows asking for commentaries and no spotlights and no money to be made, in other words, utterly sincerely. And I'm happy to say that as a result of all of this self-study, I discovered a truly progressive side of my faith in theory. You see, I remain a struggling Muslim because of what's happening, not in theory, but on the ground. And as I mentioned earlier, the basic message of the book is that no group, no ethnicity, no religion should be immune from scrutiny on the front of universal human rights. And I believe that too many of us Muslims here in the West and elsewhere want to be immune and don't want to have our own behaviors, by which I mean complacency and passivity, not just terror, investigated and questioned. For better or for ill, that's what this book does, is it questions our mainstream complacency in the form of Islamic terror.
One of the things that you object to in the book is the use of the word hijacked in reference to September 11th. You don't like the reference that was used both by Muslims and non-Muslims, that the religion was somehow hijacked by Muhammad Atta and the others. Why don't you like the use of that word?
Hijacked. When we, as a mantra, say that our religion has been hijacked, we are painting a picture as if Islam is some plane cruising towards a human rights haven. And were it not for those 19 hijackers on September 11th, 2001, this plane would have reached its wondrous destination with nary a bump. Thank you very much. But we know that that is not true. That well before September 11th, 2001, there have been honor killings at the rate of 2 per day in Pakistan, often with the name Allah dripping from the lips of the murderers. The Iranian women have to ask for permission from the men in their lives to travel. Christian humanitarian workers are shot point blank in places like Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Shia Muslims are targeted by Sunni Muslims in Pakistan.
So September 11th then was, if nothing else, the moment of the spotlight, the moment when other people started asking
precisely
these same questions. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Your chance to join my conversation with Irshad Manji. We're discussing her new book, The Trouble with Islam, A Muslim's Call for Reform in Her Faith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Irshad Manji, author of a new book called The Trouble with Islam, A Muslim's Call for Reform in Her Faith. Irshad is currently a writer in residence at the University of Toronto. She hosts a television program on the TV Ontario network called Big Ideas, and her producers would dearly like to have her back in the host chair, but she's busy talking about her book around this country. 1-800-423-8255 is your chance to join in that conversation. We're going to go first to Buffalo, New York, and Ali is joining us. Ali, thanks for calling.
Hello, and salam to Sister Irshad.
Thank you, Ali.
I recently took my shahada. I'm 20 years old. All my life, I've basically been grown up as a Catholic. My father is a Maronite Catholic from Syria, and my mother is Pakistani, and she converted to Catholicism. And I wasn't really basically all I was exposed to of Islam was, you know, the suicide bombings in Jerusalem, 9/11. And one day I just decided, you know, just pick up the Quran from my father's library and just read it. And, you know, I never received as strong of a message as I did from the Quran as I did when reading the Bible or the Torah or, you know, the works of St. Augustine.
What hit you, Ali?
What's that?
What it hit you when you read the book? What surprised you more than anything else?
The simplicity of it, really. I mean, no bishops, no hierarchy. Your faith is so personal to you. And one thing that really stands out to me is, you know, the phrase, no compulsion in religion.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's emphasized in Islam. And what that really means to me, obviously, some people can interpret that as, you know, no one can force you for your iman, your faith. I take it a step further and compare it to, like, you know, there's no compulsion in breathing. It's just done by your nature. And one phrase that was said to me when I took my shahada was, you know, in the Arabic, welcome to your nature. That Islam is really, you know, just subject being, you know, submitting to God. And I think that's...
Irshad also talks throughout the book about the way that people choose to interpret the text, and it's actually some of the angrier writing in the book when you read it. Do you also listen to that, watch that, feel that same sort of frustration at the way that the text is also used for different reasons?
I certainly do, and you know, it hurts. It really does to see something, what I view as so beautiful, just being desecrated like that. And you know what, to a large part, we all have to take responsibility for it. What I see here in the States is a certain benign neglect towards our society, towards our government, no participation whatsoever. We come here for the education, and we just go home, and that's it, and we bash everything. So on that point, I certainly agree with Irshad.
It's very refreshing to hear, Ali.
What would you two see changed, though? I mean, if you could change that benign neglect into something that was either creative or motivating, well, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about changing the way that people worship in the mosque? Are we talking about the way that people participate in their society?
You know, Ali, if I may jump in here, it may sound a little too reasonable, a little too perhaps even easy to say this, but believe me, in the in various Muslim communities, both in the diaspora and in the Islamic world, this is not so easy, and that is to have much more open debate and discussion. Let me give you a very quick example of what I mean. I was in Chicago as part of the book tour, and in and among the large audience that was there to hear, couple of women wearing hijab, and they glared throughout my formal remarks. And then during the Q&A, as more Muslims began debating and discussing with one another, obviously, you know, disagreeing with one another on various points, they came to realize that what this is all about for me is to create conversations where none existed before. So toward the end of the evening, one of the women in hijab said, you know, it's absolutely true as far as I'm concerned that Muslims need to start taking responsibility for our role in what ails Islam. And then, almost as a subconscious afterthought, she put her hand over her mouth and she said, oh my God, I hope there's no cameras on me because I'm not allowed to say this. And I said, wait a minute, what do you mean you're not allowed to say this? She said, well, I'm Arab American and, you know, the organizations that, you know, frankly claim to represent me don't want to hear this. And I said, yeah, you're Arab American, but you're Arab American. And we had a wonderful conversation after the event was over, to the point where she actually, you know, wanted a photo taken so she could put it on her website.
Ali, what do you think as you look at the perspective from Buffalo, New York, whether or not the conversation is people are feeling any more free to express the sort of ideas that Irshad's talking about here?
I believe there is a genuine will to change. Not necessarily, you know, their personal faith, but to, you know, accept certain parts of our society here in the West. But some of us feel like, you know, the outside is they're being poked and prodded and almost, you know, kind of being inveigled into change.
But Ali, would you also agree that there is a certain pressure from the inside to shut up and toe the line?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost, you know, in any sort of fanatic or extreme environment, you always have the pressure, you know, to conform. Obviously, that's true in
any faith.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, but within mainstream Islam today, I mean, Ali, the kind of Islam that is represented by these political organizations that the young woman in hijab was referring to, is there also a political pressure for us as Muslims to not tell the truth, to basically play the victim and deny our own personal agency?
You definitely do see it. And if I can relate to a story real quickly, I went to a mosque in New Jersey where my uncle lives, and we invited local police informant just to speak about domestic abuse, which definitely is a factor, especially in the Islamic community. I can speak about it within my own family. But we invited our sheikh, the imam, to get up for the mosque. He puts both his hands up and says, you know what? I know nothing about this. I can't even say a word because it doesn't happen in Islam.
Right.
Ali, I want to thank you for calling us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you, sister.
Thank you very much.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Ottawa, Canada now. Shima Khan has been listening along. Shima is chair of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Canada. Did I get that right, Shima?
That's right, one of these political organizations.
Yeah, actually, this young woman mentioned CARE as a particularly problematic organization.
Oh, I suggest you should join up and help them out and change them.
Now, Shima Khan writes a review of Manji's book called A Flawed Vision of Islam. It's very harsh. She uses words like half-baked, academically discredited theories. And I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to hear, Shima, what your objection to the way that Irshad has presented the book is. If you were to try and distill it down to something that doesn't become necessarily too much of an argument that the rest of us can't access, what would it be?
Well, I'd say basically 2 points. One are the inaccuracies in the book about historically as well as basics about Islamic teachings. And second is you know, the tone, which is so, I'd say, abusive and, you know, just very harsh.
And the inaccuracies that you're talking about, Shima, are these inaccuracies of interpretation or just wrong dates and wrong names?
The issue of the dhimmis, which she brings up, you know, in Islam when there were Islamic states, when you have an Islamic state, then the people who are not Muslim, they are exempt from religious duties because they have a different faith, and one of these includes paying taxes, if you like, to the state, and those who are not Muslim are protected by the state, and they're given this status called dhimmis. In her book, she makes it out to be second-class status, you know, not of being subject to a special tax, which Muslims are not, et cetera, et cetera. And there's absolutely no mention whatsoever of the context of it, of how many times they were exempt, how even Muslims were asked to pay this tax because of circumstances. I mean, historically, there's a lot of inaccuracy in there.
Shima, if I can, because I know you'll get onto your second main issue with the book, and let me just respond. First of all, I say this with the greatest of respect, and when I say respect, that's not a throwaway line, Dick. As Shima knows, I have posted her scathing criticism of my book on my website precisely because I believe enough in democracy to encourage dissent of all kinds. With that in mind, this second-class status of Jews and Christians, Shima, it's not just me who has documented this. You may know, if you go to the sources and notes section of my website, that Abdulaziz Sakadina, a very well-respected professor of religion at the University of Virginia and himself a practicing Muslim, has documented that there was a legal paper called the Pact of Umar that laid the foundation for laws in 9th and 10th and 11th century world of Islam. And this discriminatory document came to be accepted in the world of Islam, he says, as a, quote, divinely sanctioned system of discrimination.
I need to interrupt the two of you here because it's the sort of argument that we can't follow. And maybe it's better to take a look at it from a broader sense, because one of the things I puzzled about reading the book was, and you made the point earlier, Irshad, that you have studied the Quran, mm-hmm. and you use examples from the text to say, see, there is latitude within this religion for equality. There is latitude within this religion for all these things that we ought to make room for and don't.
Something that people like Shima don't bother acknowledging.
But wait a second here. Mm-hmm. Isn't it exactly the same thing that the fundamentalists do?
Yeah.
They also draw from the Quran and say, see, it proves that I can be this way. So
exactly.
So, Shima, where do we end up if we have people on one side saying the Quran teaches me this and people at the other side pulling from the Quran, selectively or otherwise, and saying, see, the Quran teaches me this. How do you make sense of what the religion really is all about?
Well, I go back to your earlier caller, Ali. I mean, first and foremost, each of us will be responsible for our own actions before God. This is what we believe. And I think the best we can do is to, you know, for each of us to come with sincerity, as Irshad mentioned earlier, with the desire to always continually improve and to seek God's pleasure or to seek God's mercy as we evolve in our faith, as we evolve in our understanding. And I think, you know, Islam does not have a central clergy like the Catholic Church does. It does have bodies of scholars in different parts of the world. I think this is one of the weaknesses that we do have in the sense that there does not seem to be any kind of central, I wouldn't say authority, but it's perhaps too scattered at the moment.
Are you agreeing with Irshad here when you say that there's no one authority that's teaching people how to interpret the Quran, Shima?
Well, you know, people will go to different scholars. Traditionally, that's what it's been like, you know, especially if you grew up in the Middle East or in a Muslim country. You have, you know, people who are recognized and respected for their learning, and they impart their knowledge and their understanding to people. And you accept it or you reject it. Perhaps you have more latitude to do so here in the West or in places where there is no...
You definitely have more latitude here in the West.
Exactly. So, I mean, in the sense that, you know... Right now, yes, people may take it, pick and choose what they like, but it's not a static situation. It is going to evolve. There are definitely calls for reform,
So, Shima, what's wrong then with the tone of the book? What's wrong with somebody doing the sort of real kick in the seat of the pants to say, wake up?
There's a very telling phrase in the Quran that says, and it's addressed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. It says, if you had been harsh with them, they would have been repelled from you. And this is, if you like, if you're going to be harsh with people, they're not going to be as open to what you have to say than if you approach them with a bit more respect.
Shima, you know as well as I do that some people within the Muslim community, particularly the Muslim establishment, which I think you represent in a much more civil way than others, aren't open to the message anyway. Why? Because the fact that a young feminist woman is writing a book like this undermines their authority, undermines their monopoly on power. But hold on a second, Shima. Let me finish. I've let you finish. And it's actually not the establishment that I care anything about. It is the individual, ordinary Muslims who know that they are not represented by the establishment, but still feel the pressure not to speak up because they fear persecution. Shima knows this, and I can tell your audience this, that I have been absolutely astounded by how much love and affection and support I am hearing from people like that. But they need to find a way, need to be given permission to express their concerns and their dissent with the way Islam is being practiced today. And that's what this book gives them.
Shima, back to you.
I don't deny that. I mean, you know, I've gone through a similar struggle that Irshad talks about when I was at Harvard. I mean, you know, a lot of questioning. I told terrible things to believe, especially as a woman. And Islam was on thin ice for me as well. And I went through a period of anger like many of us do. And what I came to realize is that it is very personal. It's between me and God. And I will continue to, you know, I've studied the Quran and I continue to do so. I wouldn't call myself part of the establishment. I'm just, you know, a mother of three kids trying to do what I can.
You're the president of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Canada. Come on,
well,
be honest, Shima.
So what does that mean?
Just
that she has a position of directing the way people relate to each other? What's the point that you're making with this?
Me, that is Dick.
Yeah.
She and her group are at the forefront of depicting Muslims as nothing more than victims. Hold on, that's true, and you know it. Ishad, if you read my
op-eds in the Globe and Mail, I've criticized this reliance on victimhood. I've even said this in my review, that we have to stop relying on victimhood. And I think that's a very unfair, inaccurate assessment.
But in the press releases that groups like yours put out, you know that you never talk about the fact that we Muslims also have a share in the responsibility to advance ourselves intellectually and otherwise. If you can do that, then I think we have common ground.
No, when we talk to Muslim audiences, we tell them, you know, stop blaming, stop...
Not also say that to non-Muslim audiences? Do you want Muslims to be just depicted as only victims?
Is that your agenda? No, that's not our agenda at all. It's, you know, we have it multifold. I mean, let's face it, after 9/11, there have been terrible abuses. And to be honest, I think that we as a community should stand up against those abuses.
We should also stand up against terrorism.
We've done that as well. We condemned 9/11 within hours of it happening. We've condemned, violence elsewhere outside of Canada, and we also want to help Muslims who have been victims of civil liberties violations. And to deny that, I think is to have a very imbalanced view of what's going on.
But I don't
there are
deny
people
that.
Have suffered
I am
terribly.
Saying I am saying Shima that organizations like yours have a long way to go in holding Muslims responsible for the way that we treat others, including fellow Muslims,
with respect to
human rights violations especially.
I don't deny that at all, but, you know, to change...
Love to hear people, a press release on that.
Hang on a sec. Go ahead. Shima, go ahead,
please. If you want to change the way people think, it takes a long, long time, and you have to do it in steps, small steps. You have to do... It doesn't happen overnight. And I think this is one of the weaknesses of the book. Your book is a very impatient book. To me, it's you know, if you read Jessica Stern, she's at Harvard. She's just written a book about terror in the name of God. Excellent book. She looks at terrorism from different, different faith groups.
Shima, I need to stop you there because I just want a quick response from Ishad to the idea that it's an impatient book.
An impatient book? I have been fighting within the Muslim community for religious reform ever since the age of 8. I am now 35. Yeah, change, major change may not happen in my lifetime, but somebody has to be a catalyst. Somebody has to put a book like this out to be able to
there
say...
There is a banging on the fist tone to the book. It's like, Let's sit up. Let's talk about this.
Precisely. What is unreasonable about saying let's talk about this?
I'm sure that it was unreasonable. Impatient. I thought impatient might be not a completely unfair way
from the age of 8. You try working as hard as I have since the age of 8 to get people even to discuss these issues.
Her name is Irshad Manji. She is my guest this hour. We're talking about her new book, The Trouble with Islam. Shima Khan, I want to thank you for being with us on the program. And remind our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think about the way, the direction for change? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Ms. Magazine called her a feminist for the 21st century. Her name is Irshad Manji. She is my guest this hour on The Connection. Her new book is called The Trouble with Islam, A Muslim's Call for Reform in Her Faith. You got a little bit of a sense a couple of minutes ago of the sort of debate that it is sparking within the Muslim community. That debate is going on, including non-Muslims as well. Irshad made the point, and I'll repeat it, that the criticism of the book is also included on her website. And we have links to her website at www.theconnection.org. You can find out both more about the book and the author and what people are saying about it and some of the ideas expressed there. But let's go back to what we do here, which is bring callers onto the program. 1-800-423-TALK. And next to Ashland, Massachusetts, Imran's joining us. Imran, thanks for calling.
Hi. I just want to say that when I listen to Irshad talk, I think what I see most blatant, I guess, in the argument is that it's confusing religion with political, socioeconomic, and cultural factors that exist throughout the Islamic world. And I think that if you take into account the practices in Central Asian culture, Middle Eastern culture, and even African culture, they tend to be patriarchal societies. And I think that these societies tend to look for things in the religion that basically support their way of life, rather
aren't you saying that the people who are interpreting the religion in those countries are making the confusion between religion and culture? Or are you saying that Irshad's doing the same thing here?
No. I'm saying that that people in those countries do that. And I mean, in essence, I agree with what she's saying. I think that there should be a call for ijtihad, and there should be kind of a reinterpretation and re-understanding of things in the Quran as it relates to today's world. But the issue I'm taking is that when she criticizes Islam and says that Islam does this or it means that, it's not the religion per se that's doing it. It's the people that are in the religion that are interpreting. And if I could draw an analogy, it's like saying that slavery, the Atlantic slave trade and the Ku Klux Klan, who derived a lot of their authority for what they were doing from the Bible, connotes that the Bible is actually endorses slavery and prejudicial values, and that's not true. It's the people that are in the situation, given the current context of history and politics and culture, and they're pulling what they want out of the religion to support it. And the same is true with Islam in the world.
Actually, Imran, I make that point very strongly in the book, that the Quran is so profoundly contradictory, as are all of the other sacred texts, that any reading of it, any interpretation of it, will necessarily be selective, including a liberal interpretation of it. I'm at least honest enough to acknowledge that my hoped-for interpretation is as selective as that of fundamentalists. But Imran, you also made a very important point by mentioning the word ijtihad, which is something, Dick, you and I have not had a chance to discuss yet. Ijtihad is ultimately the aim of this liberal reformation of Islam. Ijtihad is Islam's lost tradition of independent thinking, independent reasoning.
What do you mean by lost tradition?
Well, I mean that it reigned during the golden age of Islam, roughly between the 9th and the 12th centuries of the Common Era, actually because of the spirit of Islam. Of ijtihad, 135 schools of thought flourished at that time. Muslim scholars in Spain would teach their students to abandon scholarly opinion if they their own conversations with the very ambiguous Quran came up with better evidence. And Cordoba, probably the most sophisticated city in Muslim Spain, had 70 libraries. That number rivals libraries of any cosmopolitan city today.
So what happened to ijtihad?
It's a good question. In a nutshell, if I can, toward the end of the 11th century, something absolutely catastrophic happened in the world of Islam. The gates of ijtihad closed. The doors of independent thinking were deliberately slammed shut for political reasons. The fragile empire at the time, from Iraq to Spain, was experiencing a series of internal convulsions. And in an effort to protect the empire from further division now having been defined as a crime, the caliph, the main Muslim leader based in Baghdad, closed political ranks, and within a few generations, Baghdad oversaw the closing of the gates of ijtihad as well, which meant that debates froze, study ceased, interpretation pretty much stalled, and this led not just to a pretty rigid reading of the Quran, but also to a collection of legal opinions known as fatwas that scholars could now no longer question or overturn, but could only on pain of execution imitate, and for about the next 1,000 years, with few exceptions, that's what's been happening in the world of Islam.
We've done several programs over the last couple of years, Irshad, on the Arab Human Development Reports, 2002, 2003,
right.
Arab scholars saying, you know what? We have our own problems.
Yeah.
We should clean up our
That's
own house.
Right.
Is that ijtihad? Is that the same thing?
It can lead to ijtihad, but ijtihad refers to an independent thinking of the Quran itself, because again, and this is a point really worth emphasizing, the Quran is not consistent, it is not perfect, it is, like every other sacred text, very much, frankly, at war with itself on major issues such as religious pluralism, women's equality, and slavery, so that when we as individuals bring our moral filters to the Quran, we can decide for ourselves what to emphasize and what to downplay. Interesting about the UN Human Development Reports, consistently they have identified three major deficits in the Arab Muslim world: that of women's empowerment, that of knowledge, and that of freedom. And what I'm arguing in the book is that by helping to close the deficit on women's empowerment, we can also put a dent in the deficit of knowledge and freedom.
All right, Imran, thank you for that. To Providence, Rhode Island next. Sally's joining us. Hi, Sally.
Hi. First, more important than my question, I want to thank you, Irshad, for being so
inspiring and courageous and for writing a wonderful book.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you. I am a Muslim woman, and I live in the United States. And you had said earlier that you consider your book to be a catalyst for a more open future. Where do you see venues for feminist Muslim women?
Right. You mean in the West?
Yes, actually, I mean in the West.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that we Muslim women have a better job to do is convincing and, really urging our fellow feminists, if I can put it that way, Sally, I'm not assuming you are one, but feminists, and I consider myself one, have been remarkably silent about the human rights abuses that are happening, in the world of Islam, in the name of your God and mine. Now, that's not to say that no feminists have said anything. Clearly not. I mean, there have been venues, forums, conferences, and so forth.
I'm thinking of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women in Afghanistan,
right,
is a good example.
And I know that the feminist majority, the organization here in the States, has been a major, major supporter of RAWA. But I believe, Dick, that this needs to happen on a much grander scale. I think the problem today is one of reflexive ideologies taking over. There is so much reflexive anti-Americanism going on that many of the criticisms that we liberals would have about human rights abuses elsewhere in the world in the name of religion are being stifled by the supposed imperative to bash Bush. And I would argue that for all of the Bush bashing that may have to go on in the name of social justice, the two are not mutually exclusive. We can't support human rights. We must support human rights. Fellow liberals and feminists and gay and lesbian activists and all of the, usual suspects, if you will, who have become very unusual today on the human rights front, need to acknowledge our responsibility for standing up for others' rights.
Sally, thanks for that. Next to Nagme, who's calling now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Nagme, thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Thanks. I actually have a comment and a question. Basically, throughout this talk, Irshad's been calling her book and her arguments a catalyst. And the implication of that is kind of that she's kind of raising a debate, if not for the first time, in a way that hasn't been raised before. But for the past two centuries, at the very least, both inside the Muslim world and outside, there's been a whole slew of these kinds of arguments, a reexamining of the text, reinterpretations of them. And my question is, why has she not put herself, at least on this show, within a whole genealogy, as my professor calls it, of people who are doing the exact same thing? And if she is not putting herself within the context of these people who are doing the same kind of interpretive work, if that's on purpose, and if it is, how does she see her own work completely different from the rest?
Right.
So that it makes her work a catalyst and the rest of them just mere reinterpretations of Islam.
Thank you for that question. I did not mean in any way to put myself out at the forefront of anything. I make it very clear in the book that I don't consider myself a leader as such of any kind of a conventional movement. When I say catalyst, by the way, I'm actually using the word that many people who are writing into my website to support this, and these are young Muslims and Muslim women in particular, are using. And by the way, just to really hammer home the point about my own intended humility anyway, part of the book, caller, is dedicated to the many individual Muslims who have already taken chances. And I'm often very insistent on making the point in interviews that I am by no means the only voice in the Muslim world today who is calling for liberal reform. We know, for example, that Shireen Ebadi, the Iranian human rights activist, has been doing this for the last, 30, 40 years, and finally was recognized with the Nobel Peace Prize, which she utterly deserves. And moreover, when journalists sometimes assume with me that there is no debate going on in the Arab world, I have to correct them that there is a vigorous debate going on in the Arab world when it comes to liberal versus conservative forms of Islam. The problem in the Arab world right now is that too many of these debates are underground, as they are in Pakistan, by the way. And the real challenge for people like me, and I'm going to assume or guess people like you, is to find ways to bring the underground turmoil and desire for dissent and debate to make it an above ground thing.
Would you, the book's out in came out first in Canada and Germany. It's out in the United States now. Where else can people read it?
Right. Those are the three. And Australia, by the way, also came out a couple of weeks ago in Australia. In the spring, it will be coming out in the United Kingdom, then in the Netherlands, then in France and Greece. And we are negotiating currently with a couple of publishers in Israel and the occupied territories to put this out simultaneously in Arabic and Hebrew.
Can you see a time when it is in Urdu and Persian and Bahasa Indonesian? So a lot of the people who, are Indonesian around the world get a, or not Indonesian, who are Muslim around the world get a chance to read it?
I certainly hope so. And as anybody who's in publishing knows, these issues are never easy, particularly when you're talking about a book like this, where, and in countries where state censorship really is the order of the day. So we'll find ways of translating and getting the message out to people who might otherwise not have access to it. But one of the great things about living, I think, in a global world, as we like to call it these days, is that I've heard from many people, many Muslims around the world who have relatives in the three countries in which this book is already out, who tell me that they've received the book through those relatives.
And what about the risk to you? You travel now with a bodyguard. There have been death threats. Your home is unusually protected. And if the book were then to be widely distributed in Urdu or Arabic, I can only imagine that the threat to your life for some of the provocative things that you say would be greater.
Yeah, they would be, and I'm not making that up. As a matter of fact, I recently had an experience where I had to turn down an interview, at least for the time being, with Arab media, a very well-known channel in the Arab world, precisely because the Metro Toronto Police have asked me not to go there yet, because we need to look further into the security options before state this message to a much larger audience.
Do you have any reservations about stating it to that larger audience?
Oh, reservations? Not in principle. In fact, I'm craving to do that. I'm absolutely enthused to do that. These are people who I think would be very open to the message. But you have to wonder, you know, just as there is a thin minority of Muslims who engages in terror, how many of that thin minority will come from that part of the audience, and therefore can I be accused of having brought it onto myself? These are very tricky ethical issues, and it's part of what makes doing this kind of work so exhausting.
Salman Rushdie, you've met him, you know him, went underground at some point because of the risk towards his life.
The advantage that he had that I don't is that he had state-provided security, because the fatwa that was leveled against him at the time was a state fatwa from Iran. So he had security with him 24/7, and my publisher and I are responsible for paying for our own security. Very expensive proposition.
Yershad, it's been nice to have you on the program. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Yershad Manji, author of The Trouble with Islam, A Muslim's Call for Reform in Her Faith. Earlier in the hour, we talked briefly with Shima Khan, chair of the Council of American Islamic Relations in Canada. Just a reminder, Connection listeners, to learn more about Yershad and her book, The Trouble with Islam, and to read responses to it, you can go to our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.